I've shed this for now. Once again, if you're following along in Scripture, that is going to be 2 Chronicles chapter 23 is where we're going to start off this morning. Well, I'll take that back. We're not going to start off there. We're going to start off with one of the most important messianic prophecies in all of Scripture, and that is the promise that God made to David. And remember the setting of that promise. David, who had been so successful militarily and who had built his own luxurious house, wanted to build a house for the Lord. And he had first been told that, yes, this is exactly what you should do. But then the Lord revealed to David that, no, this is not what I want for you. Rather, the Lord was going to build an enduring house for David, not a physical house, not a physical dwelling place, but the establishment of David's line. And so in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 and 13, God says to David, "When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I'll raise up your descendant after you who will come forth from you, and I'll establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Now, we'll look more at this, particularly in some of the lessons that we do on the prophets of this time period. The ultimate fulfillment of that is certainly Christ Jesus. Matthew begins as it's put in our New Testaments, but the very first thing that Matthew says in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1, he speaks of Jesus the Christ, the son of David, and then the son of Abraham. Okay, Jesus is the fulfillment of God's promise to David. But God also took pains to ensure that so long as there was a physical kingdom of Judah, that promise to David was also going to be manifest in the kingdom. Even when God took 10 of the tribes away from Solomon, you recall, why is it that God said, "I'm not going to take all the tribes away from you"? It's for the sake of David. It's for the sake of David. Okay? So God said, "I am not going to remove all the tribes. I'm going to keep a descendant of David through the line of Solomon reigning over the tribe of Judah." And this is all because of the promise that God had made to David. Now, in our recent lessons, we have noted specifically the influence that Ahab had over not only the kingdom of Israel, and the kings on the left-hand side of the screen are kings of Israel, and certainly we would understand that Ahab's wicked influence would have had lasting effects in Israel, but we've also noted that that influence was felt in Judah. Who can remind us, why was Ahab's influence felt so strongly in the southern kingdom of Judah? Marriage, exactly. Righteous Jehoshaphat allies himself with Ahab, giving his son Jehoram in marriage to Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab. And so really what you see there, beginning with Jehoram, are also the descendants not just of David, but also of Ahab. And because of this, we see that promise, at least from man's standpoint, looks like it's in peril. What did Jehoram do whenever Jehoshaphat died? Jehoram comes to the throne. What's his first order of business? Kills all of his brothers. Any of his siblings that could have possibly wanted the throne for themselves, he kills them all. And then later on in Jehoram's reign, as there are invasions from the Philistines and the Arabians who are living to the south of Judah, what happens to all of Jehoram's sons? Taken captive. Leaving only one, Ahaziah. Now, how is it that Ahaziah perishes? Who remembers that story? How does Ahaziah perish? Okay, so Jehu, whom God has anointed as king over Israel, and God is also commissioned to eradicate the family of Ahab and to eradicate Baal worship, Ahaziah is killed by Jehu. However, his mother, and we talked about this a little bit, Jehu didn't necessarily have the power to be able to go down into Judah to do any of this. Ahaziah happened to be in the realm of Israel at that time, in the region of Israel. So his mother, Athaliah, she takes the throne for herself, and then what's her first order of business? Kills all of her grandchildren. One is saved, and where is he hidden? In the very temple of God. Last place she would have gone, he is hidden in the very temple of God. So again, looking at it from the perspective of man, this promise that God had made to David looks like it's in peril. It's been in peril for 15 years now. But God has been faithful. So when we come to 2 Chronicles chapter 23, we see how David's descendant is reinstalled on the throne of Israel and resumes his rightful place. So we're going to look at this idea of his line being preserved. So beginning in chapter 23, we have Jehoiada the priest, and Jehoiada is the one who had rescued, his wife had rescued Joash and hidden him in the temple. Jehoiada has served as a father figure to him, rearing him, raising him, training him for the 6 years of Athaliah's reign. But in the seventh year, Joash is seven, decides now is the time is right. Now the time is right, and so we are going to bring an end to Athaliah's rule. So what he does, and we're paraphrasing some things here in chapter 23, he gets all the Levites. You have to remember, the Levites didn't necessarily live in Jerusalem, not all of them anyway. They're spread throughout. But they would come to Jerusalem because each group had set times where they were supposed to serve. Well, Jehoiada selects a time when there are many and there's going to be a changeover. He says, none of you are going home. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to station thirds of you to act as guard. This is a map actually of Jerusalem during the days of Nehemiah. But Zion, where the temple is more or less going to be the same, at least the idea of where things are. David and his house was next to the temple, where the temple was going to be. So that's why you see there, you have the temple on the upper side, the royal palace. That's just to the south of where the temple is. Now there is a wall that separates the two, but they are located right there beside each other. So Jehoiada says, we're going to station some of you as guards here in the temple. We're going to station some of you as guards at this gate that kind of goes in between the temple and the palace. And we're going to station some of you in the royal palace. But we're also going to have all the people coming, and they're going to fill the court of the temple, that area surrounding God's temple. And what you read is they do this. And you take up verse 11 of chapter 23. It says, they brought out the king's son and put the crown on him and gave him the testimony and made him king. And Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, long live the king. That idea of giving him the testimony. Well, first off, what do we mean by the testimony? What is the testimony? Yes, but inadvertently so. What's the testimony? Why is the Ark of the Covenant also called? It's the Ark of the Testimony. Because the testimony, God's law to Israel, was contained in the Ark. We won't take time to go back and read it, but if you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, and this again, remember, this is before Israel even goes into Canaan. God says, there's going to come a time when you're going to have a king, and I will select him. And as he tells the people, he's not supposed to multiply horses, he's not supposed to multiply wives, he's not supposed to multiply silver and gold. The last thing God says is, and when he comes to the throne, he's supposed to take my law and make himself a copy of it. Well, as Joash is proclaimed king, that's what they give him. They don't just give him a crown. Again, the law of God. This is the basis of your rule. This is how your rule is established. This is God's law. So they give him the testimony. Well, of course, and again, you kind of see it on the map there. The palace is right there. And so you've got all these people of Judah. They've come and they're rejoicing. They proclaim Joash as king, this boy as king. And of course, Athaliah hears it. So she comes, and whoever would have been loyal to her, and she comes and she sees what's going on, and she cries out, "Treason!" Now, I want to draw our attention to this, what it says in verse 14, because it'll have some bearing. Well, actually, even before we get that, it makes mention of the fact that when she comes, Joash is stationed, and it simply says, by the pillar. No more explanation is given for that. When Solomon constructed the temple, and this is listed in 1 Kings chapter 7, there are two great bronze pillars that are in the front of the temple. And they were given names. One pillar was referred to as Jachin. Another pillar referred to as Boaz. We're not told which of those pillars Joash was standing beside, or if it's even the idea that he's standing right in between the two. Jachin means, let me find that. I had it right there. There it is. He shall establish. And Boaz means in it is strength. So this, even visually, it's this idea of a covenant with God and these pillars symbolizing that covenant. God will establish, God provides strength. And so this picture of the seven-year-old boy, Joash, and yet here are the pillars of God that God can establish and God provides strength. Now, Athaliah is going to perish. And again, this is God's determination that all of Ahab's family was going to perish. But what instruction does Jehoiada give for her as she is going to be executed? Must not slay her in the house of the Lord. And so what we read is she's actually taken out to the horse gate, which is right outside even of the royal compound, and there she is put to death. Okay, so now Joash is king, but he is not without counselors. He has, for the first undetermined period of his reign, he has Jehoiada serving as his counselor. And how would we determine, how would we typify Joash's reign while Jehoiada is still living? It's extremely good. He's very faithful. In particular, what is spoken of at length that occurs during Joash's reign while Jehoiada lives? What's the major project? They do that, that's right. They tear down the house of Baal in Jerusalem, which, by the way, is the only reference of that kind of a temple to Baal in Judah. And remember, Ahab had made Baal part of the national religion of Israel. Israel had problems with Baal all along, but Ahab had made it national. This is a part of our national identity. And it appears that beginning with Jehoram and then Ahaziah and then Athaliah, that had also taken place in Judah. So now there is a state-sponsored temple to Baal there in Jerusalem. And this has been a period of 15 years since the death of Jehoshaphat. So 15 years, Baal has been a part of their national identity. So that is torn down. The priests of Baal are slain. So just like in Israel, as Jehu has brought God's judgment on Ahab's family, but also on Baal worship, the same thing now happens in Judah. But it's not just that. There's also a very positive reform that they undertake. And what is that? They repair the temple. And again, think about it. We've had rulers for a period of 15 years that have not acknowledged Jehovah as the sovereign God of Israel. And so that temple has undergone disrepair. Now, we won't go into all the details of this, but there are some significant things here. they were going to raise the money enacting portions of the law. Exodus chapter 30, God through Moses instructed the people that when a census is taken, then all those who are counted in the census are supposed to contribute a half shekel. So each person would contribute a half shekel, and that would then be given to the care of the tabernacle. And so it seems that's kind of the same idea here. But who is that work entrusted to go and collect all the money for the people? Which group of people are supposed to go and then get all the tax money from the people? Levites. Supposed to be the Levites. And so what you notice in verse 5, the end of verse 5, says the Levites did not act quickly. Now, if we looked in the account in 2 Kings, we'll see just how slow they were. And once again, we don't have all the chronological data. I don't know when they first gave the instruction to, okay, go collect this tax, we're going to repair the temple. But in 2 Kings chapter 12 and verse 6, it says it's in the 23rd year of Joash. They said, okay, this isn't working. You know, we're not getting the money to be able to repair the temple that we should. So what measure does Jehoiada take? How are we gonna receive the money? Sorry? Yes. Yes, a chest. We're just going to set a chest out there in the temple complex. And this may not seem like that much of an important detail, but I'm kind of fascinated by it. The first thing was, okay, here is what the people owe. We're going to go and we're going to collect what the people owe, and then that's how we're going to pay for all this. And that's not being very effective. The money is not coming in, and the Levites aren't acting like they should, so that's not being very effective. So here's what we're going to do instead. We're just going to set a box out there. And then the people can just come and give themselves. How effective is that? They're emptying out the box every single day. And just people keep coming and people keep giving to the Lord. So it's that idea that this is now more of a free will thing. This isn't the Levite showing up on your door and saying, hey, how many males you got in the house? Five? Okay, that's 2.5 shekels for you. Now this is just now people going to the house of the Lord and they're contributing freely. In fact, they contribute so freely that not only are they able just to give the money to the workmen. And there's another interesting thing here. It even talks about how they're not even making an accounting of all this. There's trust, there's goodwill. They say, okay, here, you take care of this, and the workmen are doing it. They repair the temple, and not only that, they then have enough left over. They can provide for all the instruments and the vessels that would be used in the temple. So all of this is being taken place, and it all comes through the free will giving of the people. Yes? Yes. 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 That's a great analogy, a great parallel. So when they're first going to make the tabernacle in Exodus, that's how God does it. Okay, you know, here are my people, and they've received all this gold from the Egyptians when they left. So everybody just come and give. And the people gave, and they gave so freely. So I think you've got the same kind of thing happening here during the days of Joash and Jehoiada. Well, that's the good. Joash, he 180 doesn't even do it justice. I mean, it's such a complete change in Joash from when Jehoiada is his counselor to after the death of Jehoiada. And that's really the next thing that's mentioned here in the text. In verse 15, Jehoiada reaches a ripe old age. He dies at the age of 130. And interestingly, those of you who have read along, where is Jehoiada placed? Where's his body placed? City of David? Among the kings. He is given a royal burial. because of his faithfulness, and certainly he's been this advisor to the king, so he is given this kind of royal burial. He is buried in the city of David. But verse 17, we're still now we're in chapter 24, apologies. After the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. We're not told who these officials are, but it may be that these are still some holdovers from the days of Jehoram and Ahaziah and Athaliah, because they certainly act as if they had been allied with those wicked kings. Because the very next verse says, they abandoned the house of the Lord, and rather they served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Jerusalem, I'm sorry, in Judah and Jerusalem for this, their guilt. What does God do in response? Sends prophets. And I want us to think about this, because when we read about these prophets and they come with rebuke, they come with rebuke, you know, there's messages of hope, yes, but all these prophets, they have rebuke. This is God being gracious and merciful. Judah has left the Lord again. So Judah deserves justice. God would be just in punishing them. And he does punish them. But he also sends prophets. And yes, they rebuke, but they're rebuking to try and get the people to come back to the Lord. God still wants this relationship with them. So anytime you read about these prophets coming, always think, this is still God being gracious. This is God being merciful. He wants the people back with him. But one prophet in particular is mentioned. That is Zechariah. And what is notable about Zechariah? Son of Jehoiada the priest. Now I want you to think back. Go back to chapter 23 and verse 11. When they first make Joash king, the text reads that they brought out the king's son, that is Joash, and put the crown on him and gave the testimony and made him king. And Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, long live the king. Zechariah was one of the very ones who anointed Joash as king and made the proclamation, long live the king. And now Zechariah is probably doing something he never imagined you'd have to do. He has to go to this king who has been so faithful during the days of his father Jehoiada, whom he helped anoint, and he has to go with this message. He says in verse 20, not only to Joash, but to all the people, and says, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has also forsaken you. And as a result, what happens to Zechariah? He's stoned. At whose approval? And where is he stoned? Jesus even gives us further information about this. Matthew chapter 23, as Jesus is pronouncing his woes upon the people. And he says in verses 34 and 35, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. When Jehoiada said Athaliah is going to be killed, where did they kill her? Outside the temple. Zechariah, again, here's the altar. Here's the temple, right in this area. That's where Zechariah is killed. That's how far Joash has departed from the ways of the Lord. Any questions or comments up to this point? I do apologize. I know I lecture more than anything, but that's who I am, I guess. Yes, Aaron. No, I believe that's Zechariah. As he died, so Zechariah is saying, may the Lord see and avenge. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It didn't make sense, but I would read that.
Yeah, yeah, that would be Zechariah. Okay. Well, the rest of what you read. Geography, there we are, okay. The Arameans, whoops, here we go, are way up here. Damascus is up here. Syria, Aram is up here. So we have noted, really going back to the reign of Ahab, there has been constant warfare between Israel, this northern kingdom, and Aram or Syria to the north of them. Well, now the kingdoms are so weak. And we saw that in our study about Jehu, and after his thorough regime change in Israel, Hazael, king of Aram, and his son Ben-Hadad, they had inflicted great punishment on Israel. And in fact, in the days of one of Jehu's sons, the text even talks about how there was only 10,000 soldiers left in Israel, 50 horsemen. You know, the army of Israel has been decimated. Well, now, because of Joash's unfaithfulness, Aram even comes down and inflicts wrath, God's wrath, upon Judah. And interestingly, what it says in verse 24, the army of the Arameans came with a small number of men, yet the Lord delivered a very great army into their hands. So we see the point we were making. Again, we sing all the time, thou art a shield about me. This is what God is for his people. But what happens when God's people leave him? The shield, the protection is gone. And so really what are quite small kingdoms in the scope of the world, but they have been mighty in days of faithfulness because God fighting their battles for them. But when God's protection is gone, here come the nations. Here come invaders. Here comes all kinds of evil that happens in the land because of their unfaithfulness. Well, what is Joash's end? Yeah, his own servants. And the text even says it's because of Zechariah's killing. So there is, in the house of the king at least, some who are still loyal to Jehoiada, loyal perhaps even to God. However, there's a fairly significant difference between their actions and, for instance, David. Remember David, as he's on the run from Saul, and he has opportunity on two occasions to take Saul's life, and yet what is David's response? How could I dare lift my hand against the Lord's anointed? So these servants, while we may say, okay, they're just in their cause, yet they're acting in ways that the righteous had not acted. Let's just pause here and make a comment on Joash and maybe a point of application here. We hear the phrase, make your faith your own. I don't know of a greater Old Testament example of someone who didn't do that, apparently. Because what you read about Joash is, yes, while he has a faithful counselor, and we might say, you know, a father, a parent, a grandparent, you know, whoever it is that while we're young, they give us instruction, they're showing us what's right, and here is Joash, and he's doing right so long as that godly influence is present. Godly influence is gone. And so, again, in our culture, that might be You know, when our kids, maybe they're in high school or college and they're around their friends or others more than they're around us, they move out of the house, whatever that is. And so, are they just going to now be influenced by others? Or are they now servants of the Lord truly? And not just because of, here's what I've said you should do, but because they have true faith in God. Joash did not possess that faith. Interestingly, I didn't even point this out. When the Arameans invaded, the text makes a point to say they slew the officials of Judah and Jerusalem. The very same officials, it would seem, who back in verse 17 had so wickedly counseled Joash and turned his heart from the Lord. Any questions or further comment on Joash? We'll talk about his son Amaziah somewhat briefly this morning. All right, Amaziah, his reign is listed or referred to in chapter 25. Also some very interesting things and a change in his demeanor, just like we found in his father Joash. That early on in his reign, he is faithful. It says he's not like David, you know, he doesn't remove the high places, but he is faithful. He slays those who killed his father, but he follows the law. He makes sure that the children are not punished for the deeds of their fathers. So he's adherent to the law in that way. But it would seem Amaziah really all along kind of has an idea of his own power and his own strength. And because of that, not as much trust in God. And so what we read about Amaziah is he's going to go to war. He's going to go to war with Edom. Edom, looking at your map again, Edom's territory is all in this area here. Again, Judah's here. Israel's here. Philistines typically occupied this area. Edom's over here. Well, he's going to go to war against Edom. He's raised an army in Judah of 300,000, but doesn't think that's enough. So what does he do? I'll hire mercenaries. And where does he get those mercenaries from? Israel to the north. 100,000 Israelite troops that he hires at great expense. Now, to his credit, the Lord has a message for Amaziah and says, in verse 7, O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel nor with any of the sons of Ephraim. But if you do go, do it. Be strong for the battle, yet God will bring you down before the enemy, for God has power to help and to bring down. Amaziah said to the man of God, But what shall we do for the 100 talents which I have given to the troops of Israel? And the man of God answered, The Lord has much more to give you than this. So there seemed to be some trust on Amaziah's part. He sends those troops back. Those troops aren't very happy about this, and that's going to have consequences. In fact, they go back raiding and pillaging as they make their way back to Israel. But Amaziah follows the word of the Lord, takes his 300,000 men, and then has an absolutely bloody campaign versus the Edomites. When you read that about all the Edomites that are slain, and then even the captives that are hurled down to their death, I don't see that as God having instructed Amaziah to have acted in such a way. You don't read that instruction from God. I think you find, again, a king who's taken things into his own hands. He's going to exert his own power. He's going to act just like the other nations would in executing his foes. So he does that. But then significantly, what does he bring back from Edom? Brings back their gods and starts serving them. Now, this is not without historical significance. Nations, if they conquered other nations, would not only sometimes give credit to their god, but would also say that, you know, the God of this nation that I conquered was on my side. And maybe that's what Amaziah is doing here. You know, yes, Jehovah is giving him victory, but it's also that the God of the Edomites, you know, betrayed them and was on my side. So I'm also going to now honor the God of the Edomites. So he turns and he worships the gods of Edom. And it says in verse 15, the anger of the Lord burned against Amaziah. And he sent him a prophet who said to him, why have you sought the gods of the people who have not delivered their own people from your hand? And Amaziah's response is not one of listening to the Lord. Rather, he says to him, have we appointed you a royal counselor? Stop. Why should you be struck down? The prophet stopped and said, I know that God has planned to destroy you because you have done this and not listened to my counsel. And so what you read about in the rest of Amaziah's reign is this destruction that comes from the Lord. Remember those 100,000 troops from Israel? They went back their way. They were pillaging. They were harassing the Jews. Amaziah apparently believed that this was with the approval of Joash, the Israelite king. So he goes up. He's going to make war against Israel. The Israelite king scoffs at him. He's like, I don't know who you really think you are. You know, you've had a victory. That's great, but now you really think you're big and bad and you're going to come and you're going to overpower me. So you've got two kings here that are not righteous. They're not following in the ways of God. Yet God gives Israel the victory. And it is a thorough victory over Judah. Amaziah is taken captive. The Israelites, they march on Jerusalem, destroy a significant portion of the city walls. They loot. And Amaziah is taken back into Israel, into captivity. We do not know how long he would stay captive. The text does mention that he would live 15 years longer than Joash, king of Israel. So it may be that we're to imply that once Joash, the king of Israel, died, then Amaziah was released from captivity. Don't know. But even then, what happens to Amaziah after he is released from captivity? His servants find him, and they kill him. They tried to kill him in Jerusalem. He flees to the city of Lachish. They find him there, and he, just like his father, is killed by his own servants. We started by noting the line of David. Significantly, in that promise that God had made to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, he goes on to talk about that if David's descendant, you know, transgress God, then God would bring him back in the line. You know, God would punish him. That's not the Messiah. That's not what happens with Jesus. But you see that happening over and over again with the physical line. And all for the purpose of trying to bring the people back to God. Now, I mentioned when we get into some of the lessons from the prophets at this time, this comes even into sharper focus. Because imagine you're a faithful Israelite. You're living in the kingdom of Judah, and you acknowledge that God is your king. And you're familiar with the promises, and you know what God promised to David. And here is what David's descendants look like. Killing the prophets of God in the very temple. And you're asking yourself, what has come of this promise? How can this be what God means for the descendant of David who's going to rule over an everlasting kingdom? The prophets are going to kind of define what that actually means for the people. And Lord willing, we'll get to that in a lesson that's coming up soon. You've been very kind. Any final comments or questions this morning? Yes, Ross.
King just before, when his sermon, when it says that his servants conspired, but it talks about that it was like the son of an Ammonitis,
mm-hmm.
a Levitis.
Right. Okay, so Ross's question is that the servants who conspired against Joash and killed him, the text makes a point to listen to list that one of them was a son of an Ammonitess and one of them was a son of a Moabitess. He's asking where they come. Well, we've even seen this with the royal line that the kings have married into, these other families, these other nations. And we've seen that the Israelites have done the same. You know, that there are those who are placed in high positions, that they took foreign wives for themselves, all contrary to the will of God, by the way, we might add. And so it's because of that that you then read of these various people who are from other nations as well. But even then, I had a point in the notes. Some of those who were listed as the guards for young Joash when Jehoiada is going to make him king, they're referred to as Karaites in 2 Kings 11. Those would seem to be foreign troops that had been with the line of David ever since David himself. So you've got quite a not insignificant foreign influence in the court, I would say, at this time. Oh, yes. Yeah, yep, very good point. Okay, well, Wednesday night, we're going to look at a time in both kingdoms that seems like everything's well. And, of course, we'll see that everything is not well. So, thank you very much. Ah, that's it.